Hey, it's Tom here, and welcome back to another episode of the Investing with Tom podcast. In this episode, I got the chance to speak with Queenie Tan, who some of you may know better as Invest with Queenie across multiple platforms, including YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, and wherever else on social media that people tend to post, you will probably find Queenie. Now, Queenie has a really interesting journey. She originally started out as a marketing manager before shifting to doing social media full time. And although we have slightly different investment strategies, it was really fun to have a chat to Queenie and see how she's getting on since that recent transition to full-time YouTube, as well as some of her longer-term financial goals as well. So I do hope you enjoy this episode, but for now, let's get straight into it. Queenie, thanks so much for joining me. You have been smashing it out of the park recently on social media, so I'm excited to talk to you. How did you get into the personal finance and investing game?
Thank you so much for having me on your podcast. I'm really excited to chat to you. It's always been, so amazing chatting to you. I learned so much. And even though I think we have different investing styles, I think lots of similarities, like same goals, same mindset. So yeah, it's always great to chat to like-minded people. But I started a couple of years ago. So when I was 19, I started, I guess, my personal finance journey. And I started with Rich Dad Poor Dad, everybody's favorite personal finance book. It's like the gateway drug to the whole personal finance book world.
Yeah.
And after reading that book, I was like, oh my gosh, I want to be like Rich Dad. I want to have investments. I want to, you know, not have to worry about money. So that's when I really started to save and try to increase my income so I could invest more, learning about different types of investments. And then, yeah, here we are today. I mean, I'm not like Rich Dad and I'm not a baller or anything, but I think I've been able to, you know, get a lot further than I think I ever could have if I didn't start early and if I didn't kind of believe in myself in a cringy way. So, yeah, it's been a fun journey.
Yeah, Rich Dad Poor Dad is a drug. Like you say, that's where I started out. It sort of like gets you really hyped up and you think you can sort of do anything, but you can't really. It just kind of gets you in the right mindset. That's really cool. And what was the sort of transition to starting to share some of that journey on social media like for you? What was some of the drivers behind that?
Well, I started last year during COVID, and the real driver was I honestly, in the back of my mind, I always kind of wanted to make videos and do something on social media, but I just didn't know what, and I wasn't very confident in it. But as soon as COVID hit and I saw so many young people losing their jobs, I just thought, oh my gosh, that could be me. You know, I could have lost my job. I could have been beating myself up and like feeling bad about myself for losing my job. And I knew that I would have if that was me, you know, a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I'm in such a good position now, you know, even if I lost my job during COVID, I would have been okay. But I really don't think that so many young people had that opportunity, you know, because they maybe haven't heard about Rich Dad, Poor Dad. They haven't been, you know, looking into their personal finances and they just didn't know that there was another way. So I wanted to start creating this content just for myself, you know, back when I was 19 and struggling and had no idea, just to be like, you know, it's okay. Like it's not going to be forever. Even if you're struggling now, you can get yourself into a good position. So yeah, that's what started it all.
Yeah, very cool. And you're making waves on a few different platforms. I'm probably most familiar with you from YouTube, but you've got a pretty sizable Instagram and even TikTok following now, right? Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, it's a pretty wild place. Like TikTok is so wild, I swear. It's like you'll upload videos and no one sees them. And then suddenly one day you just post a random video and then suddenly like the whole world sees it and you get all these comments and people arguing each other within the comments. And it's a pretty wild place. And yeah, even Instagram's pretty cool. It's like, it's very different because I think it's, in a way, TikTok, it's like you follow a random bunch of people and people don't go on TikTok to watch people necessarily. They just go on the For You page and whatever pops up, pops up. And then on Instagram, on the other hand, I feel like people kind of go there to follow people specifically, so you have a better engagement with people. And on YouTube, I think it's a little bit in between TikTok and Instagram. So yeah, it's interesting to see all the different platforms, but I think still think that, you know, like you can attract an audience anywhere with the kind of content you want to create. It's just about finding what kind of content works for you.
Yeah, for sure. I've never really thought about it that way, but that's a really good point, because I've seen some people put all sorts of stuff on TikTok and go from like no following to literally millions of followers or views or whatever in a matter of day. The algorithm is just sort of crazy in that world. And do you sort of struggle sometimes with getting, like, I know for me, I'm pretty much purely on YouTube and now doing the podcast, which is even longer form than YouTube, but I often struggle to get ideas across in like a 10 or 20 minute video. So how do you manage to convert some of these things to, I don't even know how long the videos are on a thing like TikTok. I sound like an old man when I say that, but what are they, like 30 or 60 seconds or something? What's that kind of transition like?
Yeah, it's been difficult. I find that it's a different type of content. Instead of giving like 10 tips or some of my YouTube videos, I'm like 21 tips and I just go through 21 tips. And, you know, on TikTok, it's just like you can only really fit in two or maybe just talk about one. And that's what people are looking for. They're just looking for like snackable information and they don't want to waste time, you know? Mm. So like you kind of need to like crop everything so it's very punchy and kind of short. And then also like adding a bit of humor to your content always works as well, because it's a younger audience generally, and people that do well on those platforms are like comedy people. But I guess with any platform, like I think adding your own kind of personal style to it works really well.
Yeah, I think you do have to be personable and kind of relatable. Like I'm not sure what it's like for you, but I know a lot of my audience, when I look at YouTube analytics, are pretty much the same age as me and probably in a pretty similar situation. And then I look at a lot of the people that I follow, and besides the 90-year-old men like Warren Buffett, most of the people that I follow are a pretty similar like age group to myself as well. So I mean, it is, I think, important to be quite relatable, and that's probably the reason you're doing so well on a lot of these platforms. But talking about money is quite an unusual thing for a lot of people. I know it's kind of like a taboo topic, and I was going to say some places, but most places really. Like you and me are probably a bit strange in the fact that we love to talk about this stuff. So what's been your experience with trying to get some of these ideas, you know, out there to the world and talk about money and be open about it? And I know in your own situation, you're really super open about even sharing your own personal numbers. So what's that been like for you?
Yeah, it's like you got to expect a cop backlash as well, because not everybody is as open as we are, you know, and not everyone sees it in the same way. Mm. So yes, if you're looking to do the same thing, people listening out there, just be ready for that, because that's what happens when you do open yourself up to the world. But on the positive side of things, like I think there are two types of people really in this world. There's like people that have a fixed mindset, or a mindset of like there is a limited supply of like money or success out there, you know, and they see people that are achieving things or doing things that make them happy, and they're like, oh, well, they're successful or they have money, that means I can't have money, you know, and they think of things like that. And then there are other people that think, oh wow, that person has money and they're successful, how can I learn from that, you know? Mm. And I think at the end of the day, we don't want to be attracting the people that have that scarcity mindset. We want to attract the people that have that growth mindset and the mindset that there's abundance. And just because somebody's successful doesn't mean you can't be successful. And there are so many things we can learn by collaborating and growing together, because when you're just working alone and you don't have people to talk to, you're working in like a vacuum, there's no way that you're going to get ahead. Like there's just no way, you know, we need to work together. And that's Yeah, I think that's the most important thing. So that's how I've tried to look at it, I guess.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I think some people interpret that stuff as maybe even like bragging or trying to do that sort of thing, which it's really not. You're trying to say, you know, I'm just an everyday like Joe Bloggs and I've got to this point. So you probably can do it too if you follow some of the things that I'm talking about. And I think that's a pretty important distinction to make. What do you think are some of the main things that people could be doing that the average everyday person that's just working a 40-hour week or whatever it is, maybe could be doing to improve their finances?
I think the first step is to know what you want to achieve, because it's kind of like, you know, when you're at the gym and you're doing a workout. I don't know if you do classes or whatever, but I actually do classes. And I don't know about you, but whenever I'm doing my reps, I'm like looking at that clock and I'm like, is it over yet? Like, when's it over? When can I move on? And like, oh, okay, there's only 5 more seconds. I can do 2 more reps. And that's how I like to do it. But if I don't know when it's ending, or if I don't know when the class is over, like, I just feel like, what am I doing? You know, can you imagine being in like a never-ending fitness class? You just don't know when it is going to end, you know, and you're just running around like, oh, you know, that's what finance can be like.
Yeah.
So I think if you have that goal in mind, you know when it's going to end, you know, maybe if I push a bit harder, I can get there sooner, or I can get these results. That's why I think having that goal from the get-go is so important. And it can help you stay motivated to really achieve that goal. So whether it's saving up for a home deposit, or maybe you want to invest in your first lot of shares and save your first $500, or maybe you want to reach financial independence and live off dividends or work remotely or whatever it is, money can help you get there. Mm. And having that goal is the most important thing. And then everything else just work backwards. So if you want this goal, let's say you want to save up for your first home, how can you do that? You know, how can you increase your income? How can you save more money? How can you get more side hustles to have other income streams? There are just so many possibilities, and it sounds a bit overwhelming, like doing all of these things, but you start small, start with the things that you can control, which I think is just saving money is probably the easiest place to start. Look at your expenses, look at what you can cut back on, start there, and then start looking at increasing your income gradually, maybe asking for pay rises, maybe getting a side hustle or a side job. Even if you work Monday to Friday, 9 to 5 p.m., you still have weekends and evenings to make some extra money. So, yeah.
Mm. Yeah. And I think what you said about sort of setting a goal and working backwards is really important. Like, it's one thing to say, I want to save a house deposit, or for me, I generally sit down and set out like annual savings goals is kind of the way I've always approached it. And then what that allows you to do is then work backwards and say, okay, if I want to save X amount of money in a year, I need to save so much per fortnight, because that's typically I'm getting paid. And it's like, okay, how achievable is this? If I'm a few hundred dollars short, how can I cut things out or do that sort of thing? So I think that's a really, really important aspect of it, even the most important aspect, because it's one thing to set lofty goals, but I find that you got to have sort of small targets that you can hit along the way. Do you largely agree with that?
Yeah, for sure. The small talk, because you want to get some quick wins, right?
Yeah.
You don't want to wait 5 years until you can hit your goal.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And have your personal goals changed over time? Like, were there, I'm assuming, like smaller targets you were looking for initially, and now they're maybe getting a bit larger? How's that changed for you personally over the years?
Yeah, my first target was just to make ends meet and to not live paycheck to paycheck. That was my first financial goal, you know, and looking back, we might always think like, oh my gosh, I still want to achieve this and I'm not there yet. But sometimes we fail to look back and be like, look at how far we've come. Like, just 5 years ago, I couldn't even, you know, I struggled to pay for my rent and my groceries. And now look at me, I'm like, you know, so much better than I was before. So yeah, I think it kind of grows with time, but it's important to take a step back and realize, look at how far you've come.
Yeah, for sure. I can put that not only in the financial context, but also the gym analogy you were using earlier. Like I competed in powerlifting for a while and have been doing a bit of strongman stuff lately. And you sort of look back at like, it's almost like, oh, look at the weights I was lifting last week. Aren't they different to what I'm doing today? But if I look back one or two or three or four or even more than that years now, it's like kind of ridiculous how far along you come. And I can say the same thing about income levels or, you know, what I'm saving each week, or, you know, if I've just analyzed a company to put money into in the share market, like how many dollars I'm thinking of putting into that today versus what I would have been looking at a few years ago. So I think it is good to put those things in context. And often when you kind of step back for a second, get away from like the day-to-day grind, you can kind of be quite surprised about how far you have progressed sometimes.
Oh yeah, for sure. I completely relate.
Yeah. So what is your, most of your social medias are called Invest with Queenie. So what is your investing strategy look like? I know we have slightly different approaches to this, but I think it would be fair to say we're probably both trying to get to the same endpoint of financial freedom somewhere along the track. So how's that path looking for you? What are your, I guess, investment objectives or strategies you kind of put in place to hurry that process along, I suppose?
Yeah, for sure. I'm a bit of a trial and error person. Like I'm somebody that just likes to jump in the deep end and then learn how to swim. So I'm sure it will change in a couple of years, but at the moment I found a good kind of mix between my short-term and long-term financial goals, with 75% in ETFs, which are just passive investments, long-term investments. Don't have to think about it. Just put money into ETFs. And I find that it just helps me in my risk profile because, the price doesn't drop that much, which is good. And then the other portion of my portfolio is also in individual stocks. So I do have some individual stocks. A lot of them are blue chip companies. I am open to some more like speculative kind of like growth companies that are unprofitable, but mostly in blue chip companies that I see that are undervalued. And I also do have a bit in crypto. So I've got 5 to 10% in crypto, and that's just purely because I think it's an exciting space. And even if I lost all of it, I wouldn't be too sad because it's quite a small position. But if it goes to $1 million, I want to have a little bit of Bitcoin. Like I don't want to keep myself.
Yeah.
So yeah. What about you? What's your portfolio like?
Yeah, well, I'll get to that in a sec. But just on the crypto thing, I saw a tweet. Someone reposted it was just like a screenshot of a tweet from, I think, 2012. And it was like this guy just kicking himself because he owned, I forget the number, but he owned like 500 Bitcoin or something. And he was like kicking himself because he bought them at 9 cents and he'd sold it at $2 or something. And then now you look back at that and you do the maths and I don't know what it is now, but it's like hundreds of millions of dollars potentially. And I actually looked up the guy's Twitter and he had this pinned tweet from like 2 weeks ago and it was like, turns out I have to do my annual update on I'm still sad that I don't hold Bitcoin because this thing must just every now and again go viral and he suddenly gets this big boost in followers every time this old tweet gets sort of circulated around. So I don't blame you for having that bit of FOMO insurance. Is that what you'd sort of call that? Crypto investment.
100%. Yeah. I would just feel way too much FOMO.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. My investing strategy is, like I said, I guess we're trying to get to a similar endpoint, but I'm obviously a lot more heavy on the individual stocks side of things. And probably have a fairly similar strategy actually to what you're doing with a lot of your individual stocks. I don't have the more speculative stuff in there generally, but I'm certainly looking for, stable companies that can grow over a period of time and are trading at a reasonable price. Essentially, that's largely what I'm trying to do. It's often easier said than done trying to find those things, but that's sort of the very high level checklist at least. Yeah, that's sort of what I'm looking for. If I can find kind of one or two things a year, honestly, I'm pretty happy. typically. Like I think if you can find a couple of those really good investments a year, you build up a fairly diverse portfolio over a period of time. Like even if you look at someone like Buffett, and I'm not saying I'm going to be the next Warren Buffett or anything ridiculous like that, but you look back at like what he's built since taking over Berkshire Hathaway in the 1960s, and now he owns like, I don't even know what it's at this point, like 90 wholly owned businesses, and he's probably got like 50 stocks or something in his portfolio. So even adding a couple of things a year, you build up a pretty large basket of things over a period of time.
That's true. It's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, for sure. And you're, I don't know if you mentioned it there, but you've also got quite a bit in real estate as well, and have quite an interest in real estate investing. Talk us through that.
Yeah. So I own this apartment, which has gone up in value, which is just really good. A lot of people say apartments don't go up in value, but they're wrong. Some of them do. but yeah, so that's been good. And we have withdrawn some of our home equity to invest in the stock market, because real estate, like obviously the bank interest rates are quite low. We're only paying 2.25%. And wow, we think that our returns in the stock market could be, you know, 10 to 15%. So that's why we're putting our money in stocks. Mm-hmm. We were looking to purchase an investment property, but haven't found anything. And also the Sydney property market has been so hot, and I quit my job to focus on being a full-time creator. So it just didn't really make sense to buy another property and have another mortgage, even though I would like to. So I think that, you know, even though it sucks, I'm still thinking from the positives, because you can't have everything in life. And then also money is freedom to me, and being able to work on something that I'm passionate about is more important to me than, you know, having an investment property, because I could always get one later if I really wanted to. So yeah, but I think property, it's been a great investment for us, because leveraging your money. So instead of, we bought it for, well, we invested $100,000 in the deposit. We got a $400,000 mortgage. So the property was $500,000. And then just within 2 years, it's now worth $620,000, which is pretty good return for an apartment. And because it's leveraged, those returns are magnified. Mm-hmm. And you can also withdraw some of that equity to invest in things like shares, or you could buy another property. So I just like how there are so many options with property.
Mm. Yeah, very cool. And you've also done some renovations, I think, to try and bump the value as well, right? Were you sort of like, were these things that you just wanted to do because you're sort of living in the apartment and you wanted those sort of nice to haves, I guess? Or were you actually looking at that from like an investment point of view, or a bit of both? How do you kind of think about those projects?
A bit of both really, because the renovations are great, because we could keep getting the home revalued. So when we did the kitchen, we got it revalued, it was worth more, we could take more out in equity. Then we did the bathroom, we could and then it just makes the place just a lot nicer as well. But the great thing about property is you don't really have to wait until you sell it to take out some of that equity to invest elsewhere. So that's why doing renovations, you could probably make more from it when you do the renovations as soon as you sell it, because of course the price of things does depreciate, like the stuff that we bought. But at the end of the day, like if we can use that capital to invest in something else in the meantime, it's still a pretty good investment.
Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't really thought about it that way before, because a lot of people will talk about some of the pros and cons of investing in real estate versus shares. And one of the big pros that often comes up with shares is you can, you know, like you can't sell 10% of a home, but you can do that with shares if you need cash for something else. But in some ways you can pull that equity out, like you said, right? So that was basically just a straight up, you know, we're paying this in interest versus we think we can get this return elsewhere kind of decision. Were there any other factors that influenced that, or you're just, that was basically the way you thought about it?
Yeah, it was the way we were thinking about it, because if we paid down our mortgage, there was no point, because we'd rather put our money to work in shares. And then once interest rates do start to rise, we could put our money back into our property and pay down our mortgage quicker. And also because we're young, like we might as well take advantage of a bit of risk in our life. Like a lot of people wouldn't want to take equity out of their homes to invest in shares because it's too risky for them. But for us, we're like, you know what? It's okay. If the price drops within the next 2 years, that's okay because we're long-term investors and it's not a short-term investment.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. And what's the financing situation sort of like in Australia? I've heard, I think it's pretty similar to New Zealand, but correct me if I'm wrong, but you don't have access to those really nice 30-year fixed rate mortgages they've got in the States. Is that correct? How's that work in Aussie?
Yeah, I think most fixed interest rates are around, I think you can only fix it for a couple of years. I haven't actually looked at how long you could fix it for, but yeah, from memory, it's only a couple of years. You can partially fix and then also do a variable interest rate as well. So yeah, because who knows how long these low interest rates will last. Yeah, anyone's guess, hey?
Yeah, that's what I'm sort of thinking because we were talking before this and I've mentioned it on several podcasts at this point. I always seem to loop around to talking about real estate to anyone that's got any experience in it because I want to learn some stuff. But yeah, we can only fix for up to 5 years in New Zealand. So yeah, that really does throw up the question of, you know, if we do see some inflation, like a lot of people are starting to talk about, which would then you would think flow on to higher interest rates. How does that change the equation? Because I'm sort of in the camp as well of, I think I can probably get a better return than what I'm paying in interest on a home loan. I think I can get a better return than that in shares. But then if you do have the situation where mortgage rates go up massively, that equation can change quite a bit. So I would love to be in the States and be able to have that just fix it for 30 years and not really worry about it. But unfortunately, we don't get access to that.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a funny one to try and figure out. And I know a lot of people are sort of always determined to pay down the mortgage. It seems like the kind of thing that everyone just wants that recurring payment out of their head. But I know that a lot of people that tend to go towards more what you're doing often tend to come out the other side a lot better because interest rates have stayed so low for so long and, you know, share markets have done quite well. Do you have any thoughts on why people are so obsessed with paying down their mortgages?
Okay. So I think people are obsessed with paying down their mortgage really quickly because there are so many books that are about that, but they've been written such a long time ago and the interest rates are very different to what they are today. So of course, when interest rates on mortgages were 10, 15%, people would want to pay them off as quickly as possible. But nowadays, they're only 2%. So I don't think that there's a lot of literature being circulated into the market. So I just don't think that people know. And on the other side, I also think that people are a bit risk averse. So, you know, what's that saying? It's like a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. Like yeah. People would prefer to have something that's like a safe, sure thing. You know, they will pay down their mortgage and they will save a 2.5% interest rate rather than risk their money in the stock market and potentially lose some money in the short term. So yeah, what are your thoughts on it? What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think we're in a weird time with the amount of money printing going on and the low interest rates for a really long time. And I think that has changed the equation a lot. Like you say, when interest rates were 10% or like, you know, I have my parents and people in their generation tell me about when they were paying 20% interest on their mortgages and stuff like in the 70s and 80s. And it just is mind blowing to even try and process how that would work in my head. Presumably house prices were way lower, but they just got these huge interest rates. So yeah, I don't know. I guess the $1 million question or multi-trillion-dollar question is kind of like, are interest rates ever actually going to go up again? And if they do, maybe paying off your mortgage would be a good thing. But if they don't, like nobody really knows. So it's a really hard one to figure out. And I think, like you say, people are quite risk averse and probably just get quite, a lot of people I think are intimidated by investing in shares or investing in the stock market because they see the daily fluctuations, or they've seen the, you know, in New Zealand and I think Australia as well, the, you know, the 1987 crash and then the dot-com bubble and then the global financial crisis. And they see all these stories about people losing a lot of money. But if you actually look back and, you know, if you'd used a strategy like you're using with just basically buying ETFs and index funds, you still would have come out of all those times okay. And you probably actually would have worked out better off with those fluctuations because you're consistently buying and you're able to buy shares at cheaper prices and that kind of stuff as well. So it's a hard one. I think that's probably where most people are at. They just really are far more comfortable paying down debt than looking into other alternatives.
For sure.
It's a tough one. Yeah. How do you, do you think there's anything that can be done to make people more comfortable with shares, or is it just always going to be this scary, volatile asset class that people can't really get comfortable with?
Well, I don't know. I think that it's people are coming around, and I think it's a new generation because a lot of us won't be able to afford a property very young, you know, not like our parents did. So we don't really have that opportunity to invest in properties at an early age like they may have, but we can invest in ETFs and index funds. So I think that there are a lot more people dipping their toes in the water with investing in shares for the first time. And I think that our parents maybe never really were interested in investing in stocks, but I think the newer generation are. So yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I agree. The part of me worries that everyone's getting interested in exactly the wrong time. Like, you know, we're 12 years into a bull market and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, I think it's great to see people transitioning to, you know, alternatives other than property, particularly in Australia and New Zealand, where that's really all people considered for a long time. So yeah, I think it's good to see that. One of the other things I actually just thought of is, I mean, index funds and ETFs haven't actually been around all that long. So I think maybe previous generations, perhaps, that were investing in shares often were having to go see a stockbroker or investment advisor or something to pick individual companies, which you really don't have to do today. And perhaps it was more common in the past than it is now. But, you know, a lot of times people that did have exposure to shares were getting it because they worked at a public company and that was part of their compensation. And, you know, by default, they become very, very concentrated in one company. And if that goes bad, then, you know, all their friends and neighbors know that story. And then they're even more scared of the stock market. And it's sort of just like a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I don't know.
True.
Yeah. I don't know what's going to happen. I think people are getting far more comfortable with it. And I hope once people get in and see, the meme stocks and stuff, that is something that concerns me a bit, but I'm hoping they also have most of their portfolio and you know, long-term investments that are just going to be a bit more stable and compound, because the last thing you want to see also is people investing their first $1,000 or something and just getting absolutely hammered, you know, trying to buy something.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. GameStop or AMC or.
Yeah.
There's a long list to them.
Everyone's investing in AMC now. What is that?
It's a movie theater business, I think. So I think it's pretty much any stock that I see everyone talking about, I just don't bother looking at because it's highly unlikely that I'm going to find it's undervalued. That's what my experience has been. So I must say I haven't done a lot of digging on AMC's business, but actually just this morning I was looking up some of their financials because I've seen it's gone up like 20% in a day or something as we're recording this. So it's had some crazy move. And yeah, it's just a business that's been hammered by COVID and is currently taking on lots of debt and issuing lots of shares. And it
doesn't make any sense why it would be like up 20%.
And people are just, it's like a lot of these things that crashed during COVID, you know, like we saw the airlines and the cruise lines and stuff go down a lot. And then people that maybe don't have a lot of experience investing are looking and saying, oh, the share price is down 70% or something. So, you know, once we're out of COVID, it's going to go back up to where it was, which might be true for the occasional business, but for most of them, it's not, because that doesn't account for all the debt and all the extra shares they've issued and all the other stuff, which genuinely does decrease the value of those businesses, even if they get back to normal. So, I don't know how we got onto that topic. That's a few thoughts on what's going on.
And all the crypto scams as well. It's crazy. It's a wild world, hey?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you about. You mentioned earlier you got a small investment in cryptocurrency. That's something I haven't dabbled into this point. What are your thoughts on crypto in general? I know, like you said, there's a lot of pretty crazy stuff going on with cryptocurrency, but also heard some pretty intelligent people saying some pretty compelling stuff about cryptocurrency, which admittedly, I kind of had my mind shut off to it for a long time because I come from this Buffett school of everything must produce cash flow or else it's a complete waste of time kind of thinking. But what are your thoughts on crypto as a whole? I guess maybe all of the dodgy meme coin stuff aside, if we're talking about Bitcoin or Ethereum or sorry, some of these more popular coins, what are your thoughts there?
I think crypto is a cool different type of investment, and it's a different asset class. Mm-hmm. It's not a get rich quick scheme, so that scares me when people are just investing it to try and make a quick buck. For me, it's a long term investment, and it's more diversity in my portfolio. So I only invest in Bitcoin and Ethereum, and I've bought a little bit of Cardano, but yeah, definitely. I don't know. It's too risky at the moment, I think. And then it also worries me because the price has just been going up and up and up and up. And I went through the whole crypto crash in 2017. So I know that when the price is going up, it's very easy to think positively about cryptocurrency. But as soon as the price goes down, you know, people wonder what the hell they even bought. Like, they're like, why did I buy this? Like, magic internet coin. Like, what the hell is this? Why did I spend $1,000 on this? You know, because that's what I was thinking. So I'm a bit like, I see the positives. It's cool technology, and I think it could be amazing for just globalization and peer-to-peer lending. Like, there are so many cool things that crypto can do. But then on the flip side, it's like, I mean, would you really buy this thing if it wasn't going up like 200-300%? That's what I think we need to ask ourselves, you know?
Yeah, I agree. But I'm also sort of one of the investors I follow a lot is Monish Pabrai, who I think you might be familiar with. But he had a really interesting take, not necessarily on cryptocurrency, but on electric vehicles, because that's been another really hot sector. And he's sort of been... what's the analogy he gives? He's trying to find positions where he can almost be like the guy selling, shovels to gold miners in a gold rush. Like, he's, regardless of whether it works out for the gold miners, he's selling them equipment. So the analogy or the business example he used for electric vehicles was buying tire companies, because he knows for sure that vehicles in general, not even just electric vehicles, but vehicles in general, the numbers are going up and there's going to be more miles driven. And electric vehicles, if they do rise in popularity, which they almost certainly will, are also a lot heavier and tend to wear tires out a lot quicker. So, you know, is there a way that I can get in on this trend without paying these crazy high prices? And I haven't come to a conclusion on it, but I'm starting to wonder whether there's anything kind of similar in cryptocurrency where you don't necessarily have to buy the coins straight up to benefit from it, but you can buy some other asset. I don't know whether it's a broker of cryptocurrency or what it might be. But
that'll probably be overvalued though.
Yeah, exactly. All this stuff's just super hot. You got to get a bit more obscure, I feel like, but I don't know what the answer is for cryptocurrency.
I didn't even know.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I'll have to keep thinking about that one. But if anyone listening has ideas on that subject, send them to Queenie and me, and we'll look into it. Yes. Very cool. I wanted to transition a bit because you've made quite a major change in your life actually over the past, I don't exactly know what period of time, but relatively short period of time, which was actually moving to doing this social media stuff full time, which I think is very, very cool and quite exciting. And you've been even getting in the schedule of daily uploads on YouTube, which is, I can imagine, is a massive amount of work. So well done on keeping that up so far. Talk us through what that transition's been like, and what was the thing that sort of pushed you over the edge in order for, you know, taking that leap.
Thank you. I'm so excited too. I think what really made me want to take the leap was, honestly, there was a bit of a conflict at the job that I was working for. Like, I had a sponsor come on, and then I was like, oh, I can't do the sponsorship because it'll be a conflict. But then I was like, you know what, maybe this is a good excuse to kind of like quit my job, go all in. And then also I just love doing it so much, and it started to build up enough passive income to be able to live off almost, you know, not super comfortably, but just enough. And I figured that, you know, if I can just keep working on this stuff, I think potentially this could, you know, hopefully I'd be able to actually make a living off it. And I want to give it a go while I'm young. I don't want to be like an old lady looking back and thinking like, well, why didn't I do that? Or that would have been fun. Like, I just want to do it. So, and the worst case scenario is it doesn't work and I'll just get another job, and I'm totally fine with that. So I decided to go all in. So far it's been great. The thing is, it is still a bit like a job. Like, you still have to do stuff. It's not like in the movies where you see YouTubers and they're just like having fun. It's just kind of, you know, there's a lot of tasks to do, lots of stuff you don't want to do. And sometimes you just don't feel like doing this stuff, but you have to push yourself. And I try to see it as a business, not this like a passion project. So I have my tasks that I need to complete and they just have to be done. So it's been a cool transition because I feel like it's something that I'm passionate talking about. And also I'm just helping people as well. Like, I got this comment the other day and it honestly made my day. And it was this girl. She reached out and she said, hey, I followed one of your tips and I asked my boss for a pay rise and I got my first pay rise. So I'm just so happy because now I'm one step closer to getting my house deposit. And then that same girl commented on another one of my videos and she said she started meal prepping as well. So she's earning more money, but she started meal prepping so she can save more money. And I'm just like, this is so lovely because this is the stuff that I would have wanted somebody to tell me, like back in the day, ask your boss for a raise or start meal prepping so you can save more money for your house deposit. And just that I've given that to somebody else, I was like, that's amazing, you know? So yeah. What are your thoughts on everything?
Yeah, that's super cool. I would love to get to the position you're in, actually. It's something I've been thinking about for a while. And anyone that's been listening to a few episodes of the podcast may have heard me talk to our mutual friend Brandon over at New Money, who made the leap, I think, when he hit something like 50,000 subscribers or something, went from full-time physio to 2 or 3 days a week or something to then full-time YouTube. And that's worked out phenomenally well for him. So who knows, maybe sometime soon I'll have to take that same jump.
You have to do it.
Yeah, I've been thinking about it for a while. We were talking a bit offline about it before this, but looking to buy a house soon. So I'm trying to keep the income relatively steady while I sort of lead into that. But maybe once that one's checked off, I might have to reassess the situation and see what I can make happen for sure. But that's a super cool story about making that sort of impact on people. I think particularly the large, really, really large YouTubers that are making millions and millions of dollars often get a bit of flack for how much money they're making. But when you put it into the context of how much they're actually changing some people's lives for the better and attempt to even remotely put a dollar figure on that, I think the ad revenue payments and things probably pale in comparison to some of the changes that people are making. Like, I've had people reach out to me, even actually people I used to go to school with, who have just randomly stumbled across my YouTube channel somehow. And they've said, you know, I made XYZ change in my life and I've got, you know, a couple thousand extra dollars now to, again, put towards a home deposit or whatever it might be. So those stories are super cool. Do you have any other cool stories like that have come up?
Oh, honestly, I get some really lovely messages. That was the one that really stood out from the other day. But yeah, it's so true. Like, there are so many people that we can help with this message and just give people hope when it's a difficult time for everyone, I think. So yeah, it's really nice.
Yeah. And we should put the disclaimer out there. If anyone's thinking of becoming a YouTuber or something, it's not always nice comments, but you grow a bit of a thick skin to, you grow a thick skin to some of that stuff. And it's usually more positive than negative. And I always like to say that when you do get negative comments, and it's often more of a reflection on the person commenting than some of the content you put out, I think. I can imagine you get some pretty crazy stuff with something like a TikTok audience as well. Would that be right?
Oh my gosh. TikTok is
just
wild.
A whole other level.
People are savage. Do you think YouTube people are savage? People are so much more savage on TikTok, but yeah, you definitely grow a thick skin.
Yeah, 100%. And I've found that as my own channel's grown, it's sort of, I feel like, I don't know if it's just that more people are watching. So, you know, if 1% of people are going to leave mean comments, the 1%'s, you know, becoming a large number. I don't know if it's that, or if it's the fact that when you have a slightly larger channel, maybe people don't think you're going to see all the comments or something. But I feel like as you grow, you slowly have to get thicker and thicker skinned because you get more and more of these things. But there's often also of the nice comments. So that I'd probably take the growth in nice comments and bad comments, I guess, if you had to pick one of the two.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I mean, at the end of the day, like, you don't want to live your life trying to please everyone, because you're never going to make yourself happy. Like, obviously we don't want to piss people off, but it's going to happen, you know, if we're living what we want to do, right?
Yeah, 100%. And I've actually been like, yeah, like you say, you can pretty much talk about whatever you want on YouTube. I've been amazed how niche some people can go and still amass like a huge following. So if you think that you have to be, yeah, if anyone's listening and wants to start up some sort of YouTube channel or something, and they're thinking that their interests are way too niche and, you know, no one will follow them or something, I found that to be very untrue. So, yeah, you don't have to be someone you're not. Like, you can talk about stuff you're passionate about, even if it's something super obscure or super niche, like me talking about Monash Pribraia style value investing, which somehow people seem to care about. So yeah, just put the content out there, I reckon, and it'll start taking care of itself. Like, if you go back and watch, I'm not sure what your first uploads were like, Queenie, but mine are terrible when I go back and look at them now.
Oh God, I want to see this. Oh my gosh, I'm gonna have some fun after this and watch some.
Yeah, like, but it's funny because, you know, you go back to like even like Jeremy from Financial Education on YouTube. If you go back to his first videos, it's like the super wide angle GoPro, and he's talking about what is a checking account. And then his next video is like, what's a savings account? And then he's got like, what's a credit card and all this stuff. Oh, it's pretty crazy to see just the progress people make. Like, when I look at my own early videos, I was my very first video, I'm like walking through a park down the road from where I live with my sunnies on, talking about like compounding and the rule of 72 and all this weird stuff, which is pretty cringe to watch now, but I just leave it up there. So
that's hilarious. Yeah.
Anyway, I'm getting off topic. Sorry. I want to, I've got a couple of final questions I wanted to ask you that we've already talked a little bit about goals, but I was interested to hear, maybe do you have any like longer term financial goals or goals for your business or anything that you're kind of working towards at the moment?
Yeah, I would love to just have enough passive income to be able to travel. One, I would love to travel more. And two, you know, kind of not have to worry too much about working and hustling all the time, so I can just take it easy if I want to. And also just enough money to really be generous with people around me and just the world, and generous with my time and money, because that's what really makes me happy at the end of the day. And I think my short-term financial goal for the channel is hopefully make $5,000 in revenue per month. And that should pay for you know, that will be more than enough for me to live and still be able to invest some money and still be able to grow. So yeah, short-term financial goals, but then longer term, I just want freedom. And I'm not looking to become like a super rich person with like
eight Ferraris or something.
Yeah. I'm not looking for that kind of wealth. And honestly, I wouldn't even know what to do with that stuff. I just want kind of like a, you know, just like a chill, happy lifestyle. What about you?
Yeah, I agree. I say this in my videos quite often. Like it's, I think when I first started investing with like $5,000, I think it was looking back now. And at the time when people mentioned, you know, an investor or something, I'd think of investor as some super rich person. And, you know, that's kind of a thing that only really wealthy people can do. And they've got more money than they know what to do with. And they're living on yachts and have fancy cars and all that sort of stuff. And yeah, I was never really someone that wanted to get to that kind of point, but I'm pretty much in the same position as you. I want to get to a point of freedom, really. Like, as much as I like my job and as much as I like putting the videos up on YouTube and all that sort of stuff, it would be nice to at least have the option to not do that if I didn't want to, you know. That's the point I'm wanting to get to. And if I have anything beyond that point one day, it'd be nice to help some other people out. Like it's important to recognize, like, we're probably in a privileged position when we're talking about, you know, oh my God, what do I do with all this extra money that I need to put somewhere? That's a fairly privileged position to be in.
Yeah, that's, you know, very true.
Yeah. When you're even talking about investing, and I've had a bit of a leg up. I don't know if I've ever actually spoken about it on YouTube or the podcast or anything, but I went to a high school I was on like a full scholarship for about 3 years or so, it was a boarding school. So covered boarding, you know, the education itself, food, even like uniforms, even like underwear we got as part of the scholarship. Like that was a massive leg up for me. So if there's any way that I can possibly give back to that extent, I'd be over the moon to be able to do that. So those are some of my sort of longer term financial goals.
Oh, that would be amazing. That's awesome. Yeah. I love those goals.
Yeah, 100%. It's I think it's important to give back. I'm getting a bit philosophical here. I think it's important to give back. Like, you know, you only need to accumulate so much money to look after yourself and your family. So anything beyond that can probably go to someone who needs it a bit more than I probably would at that point. Although the only caveat to that is I would like to have quite a nice boat. I'm pretty into fishing, so maybe we'll leave that one on the list.
I've seen your profile photo.
Yeah, hilarious. Yeah, there you go. So maybe we'll get a nice boat at some point one day. But again, there's opportunity cost to this stuff. Every time I go and buy a Subway or something, I'm like, man, it's $5. I'll stick that in my compound interest calculator and that could be worth $5 million, or I don't know.
Everything is an opportunity cost, hey?
Everything is an opportunity cost, absolutely. One of the final things I wanted to touch on is I think it's a really cool story that you've got ongoing from YouTube as like a side hustle to YouTube as a full-time gig. And one of the misconceptions, I think, is that entrepreneurs, which you're a full-fledged entrepreneur doing your own thing now, so I'll call you that. One of the things that I think entrepreneurs sort of get mischaracterized as being like really large risk takers and people that just kind of start something from scratch, throw everything else out the window, and then kind of, you know, go full steam ahead. But I think the classic entrepreneur, and this is a Monish Pirai quote I'm stealing again here, but the classic entrepreneur is actually takes very little risk. And you were sort of at the point where you'd built up this financial kind of nest egg, or you had enough to kind of be able to take that risk and take that leap. And you actually already had a good amount of side income already coming from the YouTube channel as well, to be able to, you know, it was at the point where it was getting pretty close to like a full-time gig or part-time job, or however you want to classify it now. So do you have thoughts on that? Like, do you think that people should try and get a side hustle to a certain point? Or do you think there's a case for some people just going straight in the deep end and full send in it?
It depends on the person. I wouldn't want to do that because it would scare me too much to not know what I'm getting myself into. So I like to ease myself into it. Some people love throwing themselves in the deep end and it works. But I think most people if you look at other founders, not saying I'm like a successful founder or anything, but like most people do have that as a side hustle and then kind of wait to leave their job once they've built it up to a certain level, because it just gives you that security to know it's really going to work out and just make sure that you're not wasting your time, you know, and potentially a good job. But yeah, what are your thoughts on that? Do you agree?
Yeah, I agree. And I think the cool thing about a lot of like modern businesses is you don't really need a lot of money to get them started. Like you don't have to go and borrow hundreds of thousands of dollars and buy a bunch of factories and machinery and all sorts of stuff to build a widget like you might have had to back in the day to get a business off the ground. I think you can do it with very little money and kind of build something pretty substantial. So I certainly agree with you there. But I think more people should give it a go. Like we were talking again offline before this that I don't know if I've ever really seen many YouTube channels that have been super consistent with uploading that haven't done well and haven't like grown to something significant over a period of time. Maybe that's just a bit of survivorship bias and that's just what I'm saying. But if you're consistent at stuff for long enough, I keep using the YouTube example here, but with really anything that's even a remotely good idea as a business, I think if you spend enough time on it, it probably works all right in the end. What do you reckon?
Oh, absolutely. I was watching this video from Ali Abdal and he said it took him quite a long time to get to 1,000 followers. Like he had to upload over 100 videos to get to 1,000. Mm-hmm. And how many people quit their YouTube channels before uploading 100 videos? A lot of people, you know? And then now look at him. He's doing so well. Took Mr. Beast like quite a long time to... I think it took him like 2 years to get to 1,000 followers. And now look at his YouTube channel. It's doing so well. So I think, like anything in life, it's just about trying to improve and just to keep going. But obviously you still do want to have some traction. Like you don't want to kind of do something that's not obviously not working, but you kind of do need to at least put in, I think they say now like 100 videos on YouTube. And if you don't see any traction, then you can quit. But after doing 100 videos, you probably will see some traction.
Mm. Yeah, 100%. And I had the same experience. I think I was, because I never promoted my YouTube channel to anyone that I knew really, like I didn't share it on Facebook or do anything like that. And I think I was, I was like 6 months to 100 subscribers. And then I think it was like 14 months or 12 months or something like that in total to 1,000. And then, you know, compound interest, it kind of just goes more vertical in terms of the growth. And it's doing a lot better than that now, which is really nice. So you got to stick it out. And the sort of returns on the back end often work out pretty significantly. So, couldn't agree more with that. Yeah. Well, I think that is a really nice place to wrap it up, actually, Queenie. So thank you so much for joining me. It was great to talk to you. I hope we can keep collaborating more in the future because I really enjoy talking to you. So thanks for coming on to the podcast. So and for those that perhaps aren't following along with what you're doing already, where can people go to see or hear more from you?
I'm on YouTube, TikTok and Instagram. So wherever you like to consume your content, thank you so much for having me on. It's been so much fun to chat with you.
Cool. Thanks so much, Queenie. And for everyone listening in, I will leave all of Queenie's socials down in the show notes for the podcast. So feel free to go and check her out there. So Queenie, thanks very much.
Thank you. See ya.
Cheers.